Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's really, I think, important that we put 20-somethings in context and look at mental health in the context of, you know, what it's like to be a 20-something today. And once we do that, I think it's harder to call them snowflakes or to say they all have helicopter parents. I think we might think twice about diagnosing entire generations with problems that maybe they don't have. But, you know, it's a very tough time. It's an uncertain age more than it's, you know, sort of an unwell generation or an unwell group of people.
That was Meg Jay on Psychologists Off the Clock. We are four experts in psychology here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, a clinical psychologist practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, and author of Act for Burnout, Act Daily Journal, and the Act Daily Card Deck.
From America's Heartland, I'm Dr. Emily Edlin, a clinical psychologist based in Chicago, Illinois, and author of Autonomy Supportive Parenting.
Calling in from Vienna, Austria, I'm Michael Herold, ACT coach, confidence trainer, and author of an upcoming book on being a better conversationalist and making friends.
And from coastal New England, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and Imposter No More.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
Hey, everybody. I'm here with Emily to introduce today's episode with Meg Jay, where we talk about the mental health of people who are in their 20s. And I really loved this conversation. And I think for any listeners, whether you're in your 20s, about to be in your 20s, even in your early 30s, if you have kids that are in this young adult age group, if you're a therapist who sees young adults, you know, there's really so much rich information in this episode to really understand what goes on for people at this developmental stage. So, Emily, what was your reaction to the episode?
I got so much out of it, and I was really excited listening because I do work with this age group in my therapy practice, and I'm raising kids that will be in this age group. It reminded me, though, I have this funny story. My 12-year-old recently, in one of those moments you don't expect a deep question, right? Just regular Thursday afternoon, she says, "Mom, when did you peak?"
Oh my God.
I was like, well, first of all, I don't appreciate the assumption that
that's already happened.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I said to her. I said, "Well, I haven't yet."
Right.
And she, like, I'm planning on still peaking. But the reason I bring it up is because I think you all talk about how the 20s, there's some hype around how amazing they're supposed to be, when actually it's kind of the opposite, in the sense that there are so many huge milestones that are often being hit during the 20s that it's actually quite a stressful time and not the glory years. So, right. So that's what made me think of, no, the 20s can be rough, and I'm glad we're covering this on the podcast.
Yes. And I love how Meg points out, you know, if you do peak in your 20s, that's kind of problematic. Like, yeah. What does that say for the rest of your life? It's all downhill from here, folks, right? So it's not the worst news in the world that this is a challenging time, or at least not the best time of your life. But yes, it's like such an uncertain time. But even the discussion about, like, assuming that other developmental stages are somehow easy because you're not paying a mortgage yet, or whatever we perceive as being the stressors of, like, quote unquote, real adulthood. It really reminded me even to think about my own kids' experiences of uncertainty and how challenging that is for humans in general. And the younger you are, the less practice you have learning that you can tolerate uncertainty, that, you know, the sky won't fall if you do things without knowing everything in advance.
Well, and in this age group or this era, you know, these 20-somethings have grown up being able to Google anything and everything. And you can't Google, what should I do with my life? You know, and so it's this kind of, like we were talking before recording, this idea of these tolerating uncertainty muscles have atrophied. And the 20s are really a trigger for that skill of managing uncertainty. So I think it's a great frame that Meg brings to the whole experience of this decade-ish. You know, she even says we could call it 15 to 35.
Right, right.
But all these huge life decisions really around career and personal commitments and having children and all of it, they're all really big.
It's yet to happen, and they're huge. And all of that, you know, she also then goes on to say, it's normal to feel anxious about all of this stuff. It's normal to feel sad if you go through a breakup. And I think so many things happen in our culture that come from like a well-intentioned place. So there used to be so much stigma about mental health issues. And thankfully, that is getting so much better. But in some ways, this pendulum has swung a little too far. Right. So now there is just this assumption, if I'm feeling anything uncomfortable at all, I need to get on Google and figure out my diagnosis, or TikTok. Yep. And, you know, and now it must mean that I need therapy forever and I need to be on meds forever. And I love the way that she just really, I don't know, destigmatizes
and
the normal emotional reactions that we have to difficult stressors in life.
Right. She makes it not, it's not a pathology.
Right.
It's not.
Yes. It's not destigmatized. It's depathologized. Exactly. Right. Yes.
There's not something wrong. It's a really understandable response to what's going on in your life. And it was such a great reframe that I found really refreshing and I think will be so helpful for listeners to just absorb and start to think differently about, okay, I'm feeling anxious and stressed, but there's a good reason. I'm like studying for my med school exams. That's stressful and anxiety provoking.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and that's also not to say that if you're struggling to figure out how to manage that, you know, I, of course, I'm biased, but I think therapy certainly can be helpful for anyone. And you don't have to have a diagnosis to benefit from therapy if you're struggling with uncertainty and making decisions and whatnot. But to also not panic that this means that like something, you know, you have some serious mental illness that you're going to have to battle for the rest of your life. And what does this mean about you? And
Well, and she brings up the interesting role of psychiatry and medication and how that's kind of been being overused in general.
Right.
And I think that was a really critical part of your discussion near the end.
I agree. So listen in and enjoy this episode with Meg J about 20-somethings. Hey, everybody, it's Jill here, and I am here today with Meg J, who is a developmental clinical psychologist who specializes in working with 20-somethings. She is the author of the cult classic, The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now, and is here today to talk with us about her brand new book, The 20-Something Treatment, A Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age. Her books have been translated into more than a dozen languages, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, and on NPR, BBC, and maybe most important for her audience, TikTok. Her TED Talk, Why 30 is Not the New 20, is among the most watched to date. She is currently on faculty at the University of Virginia and maintains a private practice in Charlottesville. Meg, welcome. Thank you for joining me on Psychologists Off the Clock.
Thank you, Jill. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So I think 20-somethings right now in the time that we're in are getting a little bit of a bad rap. And you give this quote, you say, some think 20-somethings are snowflakes that melt at the first sign of heat.
Mm-hmm.
And you say this is dead wrong. So why is that? What is going on with this age group? And what specifically made you want to devote your career to this age group?
Yeah, it's funny. And you would relate to this. You know, when I tell someone I'm a clinical psychologist,
you know, oftentimes they say, oh, well, what do you specialize in, or what's your focus? And I say 20 somethings, and they usually say, why would you do that? Meaning, you know, what's going on there? And I do that. I specialize in 20 somethings because in a lot of ways, that's really where all the action is. It's, you know, from the adult development perspective, it's the decade with the most change and transformation. From a mental health perspective, it's the decade where we're most likely to struggle and to be at a bit of a mental health low point. And I think, you know, culturally, we look at 20 somethings and say, you know, what a bunch of snowflakes, what's so hard? They don't have partners, they don't have houses, they don't have mortgages, they don't have big jobs, they don't have kids. But it's actually very stressful not to have those things and to be working on all those milestones at once, not knowing how or if they're going to work out, and to feel like you don't have any internal or external senses of security. So it's a very difficult decade. Some people, you know, we say they're going to be the best years of our lives, and, you know, very fortunately, they're not.
Right. Well, it's a bit of a liminal space, I guess, isn't it? Because really, through the time you're 18, you know, you're legally required to attend school, right? So there's like sort of this plan of what's expected and what to do. And your parents play a huge role in where you're supposed to be and when you're supposed to show up. And then it's right in this kind of next developmental phase where they may not have all of those stressors, like you said, but what they do have is loads of uncertainty.
Right. That it is. Yes, it's the most uncertain age. And, you know, I think we're not talking enough about how much the brain really doesn't like that. Yeah. And especially after you shift from, like you said, 20 years of I have school and I have syllabi and I have grades and people tell me what to do and when to do it and how to do it. And there are office hours if I'm confused. And then you get into your 20s and you don't have any of that structure. And it's all sort of uncertainty in terms of how do these things work out for me? Will they ever work out for me? And, you know, like I said, the brain doesn't like a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. You said, I don't think we talk about this enough. So, and you weave it through a lot of the book. Tell us, what do, you know, evolution and science really tell us about the role of uncertainty for we humans as a species?
Yeah, so the brain interprets uncertainty as danger, that it feels unsafe not to know what's next, not to know what's around the corner. And, you know, our brain has a better safe than sorry approach to life, that it's a bigger error to miss a danger than to over expect a danger. So, you know, we won't get too far into the weeds on it, but, you know, once your brain senses danger, then, you know, stress hormones are released and fight or flight is activated and people feel stressed and anxious and, you know, kind of ready for something terrible to happen. And, you know, that might be useful in the moment when you're coming around a corner and maybe going to meet a bear, but when you're a 20-something and you might spend a decade really waking up to this staggering amount of uncertainty every day, then to live with that much uncertainty and to constantly feel this sort of a chronic source of stress and anxiety, it's hard. It's very uncomfortable.
And in the last, I don't know, 20 years, but with modern technology, our opportunities to practice sitting with uncertainty have just disappeared, right? Like if you want to know the answer to any question, you ask Siri or Alexa or Google, right? If you, before you buy, I remember being in a CVS and I needed, I think, a curling iron or something. And I literally got anxious and was like, I can't buy a curling iron without looking at reviews.
And right? Fortunately, you can do that on your phone right
and
there.
You do that. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so that's the thing is like, we don't go to restaurants or movies or buy products or find doctors or other service providers. We don't do anything anymore without resolving some uncertainty first. Whereas prior to having access to all of this technology, we really got a lot of practice sitting with uncertainty, even if we didn't realize that's what we were doing.
What we were doing, yeah.
Right.
I mean, it is true that I think another big shift from the school years to the 20-something years, and this goes for the rest of adulthood, but our 20-something years are our first, you know, kind of big experience with this, is we suddenly are answering questions that don't have right answers. So after 20 years of being in school and trying to figure out what's the right answer. How do I find it? How do I put it down on paper and get a grade for it? Now we're answering questions like, where should I live? Who should I love? What should I do? Who should I be? And those questions don't have right answers. So I see, you know, many, many 20 somethings who come to my office secretly or not so secretly hoping that I can help them find the right answer to these questions, which are also called large world problems because they can't be modeled. There is no algorithm. But oftentimes young adults are a little thrown by that thinking, well, there's an algorithm for everything else. How can there not be an algorithm for this?
Right. And our brains are so designed to try to land on a right answer. So I often do this exercise either with clients or when I'm doing speaking, and I can do it with you right now. If I said, what does this pen and these AirPods, what do these two things have in common? If you just, and all of our listeners can be thinking, what do a pen and AirPods have in common? And if you just notice what your brain does, it will churn and churn until it comes up with something. Right?
Right.
Because a brain doesn't want to sit with, I don't know,
right.
Nothing.
Right.
Right. And
it depends.
It depends. Yeah.
Right.
And isn't that often what ends up happening is this sort of like mental ping pong of the pros and the cons. And I had a colleague talk about her mental process as being a lot like being on a treadmill where she's working really hard, but not getting anywhere new. Right. But that the brain will just try to keep coming up until it gets an answer that feels like it's the right certain answer. And what a trap that is.
Right. Well, and a lot of times the answers that young adults are looking for, is this the right person for me? You know, should I move to San Francisco or Omaha? That especially the if is this the right person for me, it can take time. Somebody could book an appointment with me every day for 30 days, we're not going to find the answer. The answer is going to be in their lived experience
right.
with that person over some period of time. Maybe it'll be 3 months, maybe it'll be 3 years, but that, you know, every week that person is still wishing, I wish we knew if this was the right person. I wish I knew if I should keep dating them or split up with them. And, you know, but still there is that, I think, fantasy that at some point it will become like an answer
clear.
Rather than
yeah.
a choice of eventually
right.
it's just a choice. There is really no answer.
Yeah. I like to say to people, you make decisions and those decisions have consequences, some that you like and some that you may not like. And then based on that lived experience, you make new decisions.
Right.
You either stay the course or you pivot. And there's lots of uncertainty in every step. Of that ongoing process of choosing what your life is going to look like.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's really where, you know, large world problems, they don't have answers. They have decisions, you know, we make decisions
like
and, but, you know, looking for, waiting for, or paying, trying to pay for the right answer, you're not going to find it.
Yeah. So other than what I had just brought up about how we have so much access to information so that we don't practice sitting with uncertainty. What are some other ways that you think technology, either the internet or certainly social media, what role do you think this has played in the increased difficulties that we see in this 20-something age group?
I'll state the obvious because I think fortunately now everybody knows about this, is that, you know, young adults are really bombarded with comparison points. And so, you know, back when I was in my 20s, I could see the people around me who had maybe made roughly similar choices, or I might occasionally bump into someone who, you know, had taken a very different life path, you know, over the holidays or on a vacation or, you know, when I kind of got outside of my world. But right now, 20-somethings are bombarded with countless people who have taken different paths or at different stages of development and different levels of success, whatever you feel like success is. And so that's a lot for the brain to process because the brain is trying to figure out, where do I stand in all this? And, you know, it's really, again, sort of helping people realize you can't really rank different lives because everything about them has been different. And so you can't compare yourself to other people in terms of where they are and where you are. You may have different metrics about what success is, have different paths, different strengths and weaknesses. So it's very difficult for the brain to sort of not do that or undo that. And I think young adults know it, but every time they look at social media, like you said, the brain is going to try to compare and rank and quantify. Right. And I think that's, you know, not the best.
And especially when they're only seeing, you know, maybe 10% of what a full picture is. It's even if they were trying to make decisions based on what they see on social media, you're not doing that with all of the facts.
It's the best stuff, right?
Yeah, it's the highlight reel. What about you also talk about the difference between social awareness and social contagion? Mm-hmm. And the role, like you talked a little bit about the nocebo effect and internet rabbit holes, like the way that this kind of specifically shows up in mental health domains. Can you talk a little bit about those issues?
Yeah. I mean, this book, you know, the 20-something treatment, it's really precision medicine for young adult mental health. So it's an age-specific approach to 20-something mental health. And, you know, the reason I wrote it now rather than 10 years ago when I wrote The Defining Decade, which is really about a different slice of 20-something life, is that now people are finally explicitly talking about mental health, which is great, or mostly great. It's like everything, it's mixed. And one thing I think we're bumping into is people feeling like the conclusion to that conversation for each person needs to be a diagnosis and maybe some medication and maybe a therapist. And not all those things are accessible or even necessarily the right first step for people. So I'm pretty concerned about the number of 20-somethings who are being diagnosed by general practitioners in 15 minutes, or who are diagnosing themselves on social media, or who are being sort of diagnosed, you know, in the media as a generation. And, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily useful for people to see themselves, especially when their senses of identity are forming and their sense of self, to see themselves as disordered, abnormal, broken, somehow not okay, or where they, you know, really where they ought to be developmentally.
Yeah, it's so pathologizing, and it sort of assumes that there is some criterion of health, wellness, happiness that we're supposed to be and feel all the time, and it really kind of underemphasizes how much the way that we feel varies.
Right.
You know, depending on context and development and, you know, all the different things that are going on in life, and that's normal.
Right. And, you know, situations that, you know, of course I have clients who have, you know, real diagnoses that will be with them for life, such as bipolar disorder or ADHD, et cetera, but also have many, many clients who are experiencing anxiety and depression that are more situational than they are clinical, that they're feeling very anxious and stressed about a new job or a new city or a new relationship, or they're feeling depressed because they got their heart broken, which is the number one precursor to depression in young adults, which is really, so it's really grieving. It's not a disorder.
Right.
And so we're not talking about that enough. So, you know, I more and more I have clients come in and say, I have anxious attachment style. And so when I ask them to talk to me about that, I say, well, actually, I think you're just feeling anxious. I don't think it's a style. I think it's a state, that this is a new relationship. You're not sure it's going to work. You're going a little crazy, but that is sort of the nature of, you know, a new attachment. And that doesn't mean that you have a dysfunctional attachment style, which really suggests there's something deeply wrong with you across time and situations, which is usually not the case.
Right. And a feeling state will vary versus an attachment style is something that feels like you're just doomed to be saddled with this forever.
Right. And that doesn't help if you feel like, well, I have a dysfunctional attachment style, and you're getting out there trying to date, you're going to feel more anxious than ever, because you're going to feel like, well, who's going to want to be with me? I have a dysfunctional attachment style. So, you know, I see a similar thing with, quote, social anxiety. I put that in quotes because, you know, much of the time it's really social uncertainty, that someone is just unsure if a conversation will go well, or if somebody remembers something dumb that they said, or if they'll be able to give this presentation at work. And so it's very easy to label that social anxiety, but at the root, it's really social uncertainty. And that's normal when you're a 20-something and you're still making friends and still figuring out how to give those presentations at work and don't have that sort of baseline level of confidence that, oh, I'm likable and work will be fine and I'll figure this out.
Right. Yeah, it makes so much sense. And, you know, evolutionarily, we are social beings, right? We are programmed to want to remain connected in our, mm-hmm. in our tribes and our groups. And so worrying about whether we're going to be kicked out, what other people think of us is just a normal part of being human.
Right. And especially right? in those years, there's a study somewhere in the book I talked about, and I can relate to this because my two kids are teenagers. But at some point around the teen years, the brain starts tuning out a mother's voice and tuning in the peer's voice. And I feel very tuned out right now.
Yeah.
But it's very normal to suddenly feel, you know, highly invested and very worried about, do other people like me? That means it matters to you, as it should. And so that doesn't mean that you're inherently anxious or insecure or unlikable.
Yeah. You're caring about something you were designed to care about.
Right.
Right. Yeah. We all know there are trade-offs in life, like having to drive a little further to save on gas or groceries. But when it comes to your health, you shouldn't have to trade off. So don't go back to that one doctor who's always late and rushes through your appointment just because they're close by or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. You can search by location, availability, insurance, literally no trade-offs here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. My kid's pediatrician is retiring this summer, so you can bet I will be using ZocDoc to find someone new who we all love and trust. So go to ZocDoc.com/POTC and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/POTC. ZocDoc.com/POTC.
Small behaviors can make a big difference in our health and well-being. Most of us work so many hours each week that we should think about how our work habits affect our bodies. Being able to stand sometimes while I work has made a huge difference for me. Uplift Desks has created high-quality office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. My Uplift standing desk allows me to easily transition from sitting to standing while I work with just the push of a button. I feel so much better than when I sit all day, and it helps me recharge to change positions when I get tired in the afternoon. In addition to standing desks, Uplift offers ergonomic office seating, storage systems, even walking treadmills for your desk. You can get free shipping with no hassles, free 30-day returns and return shipping, and a 15-year warranty. Remember, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting the podcast. Visit UpliftDesk.com/POTC for 5% off your order. That's UpliftDesk.com/POTC to get 5% off your entire order.
So how do you think we, providers and parents and young adults, how do you think we might need to rethink psychotropic meds? So, you know, antidepressants, anti-anxiety meds. I think there's, like you said, a teen will show up at their PCP's office for 15 minutes and immediately be put on an SSRI. And that's not always what's needed. Certainly sometimes.
Right.
So what would you advise either 20-somethings who are listening or parents or providers of 20-somethings to be thinking through medications?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the way I describe it in the book is that medication is not always the best medicine. And I think, you know, much of what we hear is, well, we have it, you know, why not? Well, there are some why nots. And I think, you know, in those 15-minute appointments, thorough discussions are not had about some of the downside. And it's also the case that whether you go to a general practitioner for 15 minutes or a psychiatrist for an hour, that client is going to spend more time in my office telling me the upsides and the downsides of medications. And so I think oftentimes therapists actually hear more about how the meds really feel and what really happens than the actual prescribers. So some things to be aware of is that antidepressants do tend to turn the volume down on, you know, anxious or sad thoughts, but they also tend to turn the volume down on happy thoughts and motivation. So they're generally, you know, emotional blunters, and that works in both directions. So many of my clients will say, well, I feel less bad, but I also feel less good. And is that worth it to me or not? Weight gain is a common side effect. Sexual dysfunction is a common side effect. And these are important to young adults who are, you know, right at the age, as we were discussing, where they're out there trying to figure out relationships and sex. Yeah. Benzodiazepines are being prescribed, you know, for anxiety, but, you know, they have significant downsides. They're second only to opioids in terms of overdoses, and the age group most likely to overdose on benzos is young adults. Sometimes it's intentional. Sometimes they just mixed them with the wrong medication or alcohol. They're also habit forming. And so I have clients who start benzos because of their GP, and then they need bigger and bigger doses more and more throughout the day because your brain becomes accustomed to them. And then they're dependent on benzos. So that's a problem. Stimulants, very useful for people with bona fide ADHD. Even people without ADHD are using them, especially on college campuses. But an interesting study just came out that showed that neurotypical brains, when they use stimulants, they'll work harder and longer, but the work is of poorer quality. It's like,
oh, interesting. It is interesting. That one.
And it makes perfect sense. It's like going to the SAT kind of ramped up on caffeine. If you're not used to that or you don't need that, you're probably not going to do your best work. So, So I think I'm not a psychiatrist, so it's not my lane to say, do take this drug, don't take that drug. What I do encourage my clients, my readers, listeners to do is to really do their homework and to ask their doctor about the upsides and the downsides. And if they don't feel like a thorough discussion is being had about that, to go on the internet. And yes, you're going to get, you know, the extremes of the upsides and the downsides, but there is a lot more information available to people than there used to be.
And I think, I mean, this is just anecdotal, but I think there used to be a time where it was believed, you know, well, if you have this chronic disease of depression or generalized anxiety disorder, you need to be on SSRIs for the rest of your life. And that seems to be changing a little bit. I've seen more psychiatrists who will prescribe it for people to sort of get through a very difficult time if they're unable to kind of do it without assistance, but then to come off of it and see how they do.
Right.
That it's not something that needs to be, you know, done forever.
Forever.
And that's something that I encourage my clients to ask their psychiatrist about. Like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like method? I can't quite think of the word, but you know, what is your mentality really about this? Do
what's
you think I'm going to have to be
plan?
On this room? Because a lot of psychiatrists, I've had clients in the past report that their psychiatrists gave them a lot of pushback whenever they said they wanted to get off medication.
Absolutely. One of the, I don't think this made it into the book, but in some draft or another, I had what was sort of a saying that, you know, kind of a piece of wisdom that used to sort of circulate about meds, that what gets you well keeps you well. But that's the idea that, well, hey, you took these meds, you felt better, you better stay on them forever, because if you come off of them, you're not going to feel better anymore. And that really can get conflated with situations that improve. So I talk about in the 20-something treatment, a young man who came to me after a breakup. He was quite devastated, really grieving. Of course, he met the criteria for major depressive disorder. His GP wanted to put him on meds. He wasn't so sure. I wasn't so sure, because I felt like they might help, but they might also have some downsides that are not going to be useful for him. He was, you know, usually very successful at work and, you know, was concerned about the motivation piece. But also, I had every sense to believe that, you know, he's probably going to be able to deal with this breakup over the period of a few weeks or a few months and learn how to grieve and how to get through loss and really get some important work on himself done. And then when that's over, we're through it. And there are no meds to come off of, which, you know, coming off of meds can be difficult sometimes.
Yeah.
And oftentimes people panic and say, oh no, see, this is proof. I need them. I got to go back on them or I can't come off. So I was really concerned about him putting meds into the mix of what seemed to me to be a very normal and even healthy sadness that, you know, yeah. I tell clients, you know, if you get your heart broken, that means your attachment system is working properly. There's nothing wrong with you. It hurts like hell. But you can learn how to get through this because it'll probably happen again at some point.
Right. Yeah. I love that. So one of the things that you talk with your clients about when they're struggling with difficult thoughts or emotions is to talk with them about their default mode network and their task positive network. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about what those two are? And like, maybe you could give a little clinical example of how, you know, because those sound like such big, fancy, science-y words, but the way you talk about them with people, I think, I mean, I guess it's like psychoeducation when you're doing, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right.
And it makes so much sense. And I found your explanations to be really helpful.
Oh, thank you. I do. Actually, I often say to clients and in books or podcasts, education is an intervention. Oftentimes what young adults need most is not medication, is not even necessarily therapy. They need education. They just need better information about what's going on so that they can sort of panic less and cope more. So, right. So the default mode, it's kind of what your brain tends to do when it's not busy doing something else. And most people's default mode, especially young adults, is a pretty negative one. So this goes back to when we're feeling uncertainty, we assume danger. When we have ambiguous situations, we assume the negative. And that's just normal human negative bias. Again, this is for better safe than sorry reasons that your brain is being careful. So if in the book, I've talked about a med student who thought he failed an exam, you know, really got worked up about it, had a panic attack, came to the emergency room where I happened to be, and you know, was really having a hard time. And he was sure that he failed his exam. And then he had another one in a few hours and he was sure he was going to fail that one. And so, you know, obviously catastrophic thinking, worst case scenario thinking, which is what we all do when we're sort of in an uncertain situation. So part of what I did with him, because plus he was a med student, so I thought, you can understand this. Let's talk about the default mode network.
Talk about the brain.
Yeah. So the default mode network, when it doesn't have something, you know, important it needs to do, like write this paper or run to the grocery store or get focused on a task, the task positive network, the default mode network is just going to sort of hang out and stress about uncertainties and generally skew negative on those. And so, you know, I talked to him about catastrophic thinking that, you know, left to its own devices, the brain's going to imagine the worst. It's going to what if everything. But, you know, can we take some time and sort of give our brain the task of what else-ing instead of what if-ing. So what else could we be saying about that test he took that earlier that day or about the one he was going to take later that night? So I started getting curious with him of what happens if you fail a test? I don't know if you failed it. Maybe you did. What happens if you fail a test? And he said, well, we actually get to take tests again in med school. And I thought, well, great. Okay. This is sounding better already. And what happens if, you know, you keep failing and you fail this course? Well, we can actually take the courses again. And have you ever failed a test or course before? No, I haven't failed one before. And so, you know, once we looked at what else could our brain be doing besides the what if and giving it some other data, he settled down and was able to, you know, look at the situation more rationally than catastrophically. And then I gave him some marching orders for the next couple of hours of, here's a protein bar, go to the library, study for your test, have dinner, go take your test, come see me in the morning. And, you know, of course, he comes back the next day and had a few more follow-up sessions. And of course, he'd failed neither of his tests.
Right.
And in the course of it, learned that, you know, hanging out and giving your brain nothing to do besides imagine the worst is probably not the most, you know, productive use of his time, especially when he has another exam coming up. So what can he do instead? And, you know, I think that's a big task for 20 somethings because there's a lot of ambiguity of, will this person call me back? Will my boss be mad at me? Will I pass this exam? Is learning how to, your brain is going to what if no matter what.
If, right.
I cannot override evolution, But we can say, okay, brain, I'm going to give you some other tasks to do. Yeah. And that includes
Or the other thing else? I love that you say is focusing on what is instead of what if.
Right.
What right. Is. That like feelings aren't facts. Right. And so can we look at what is instead of what if and try to pull back into that like present moment reality rather than, you know, thinking through all the catastrophes of the future or ruminating about the past?
Yes. I mean, I think those two, the 20 somethings are going to what if. I mean, so are we all, honestly. But at older ages, often we can more quickly switch to either the what is, what are the facts? But here's the thing with 20 somethings, they'll often say, well, I don't have any facts. And sometimes they don't. So you have to also be able to say, okay, well, let's what else then? So we don't have facts, but what else might have happened besides the way you're interpreting it? So either of those are useful directions.
Yeah. And taking that worry all the way out to its conclusion, right? Because normally there's the what if, and then I get to what I think is the worst case scenario, and it's so scary, like I'm going to fail my test, that I just back off and sit in this anxious place. But when you go through to the, well, then what would happen? Well, then what would happen? Well, then what would happen? You know, ultimately, they ultimately tend to get to a place of like, oh, it would eventually be okay.
Right.
But you never get to that. It would eventually be okay because you sort of escape at the height of the scary what if.
Right. Or people say, oh, that's not going to happen. But I don't know that's not going to happen. So I don't say that to clients, but I say, okay, well, what if it did happen? So what if you failed your test? You know, oh, I could take it again. And then, okay, what if you failed the next one and the next one and the class, whatever. You know, this student was able to say, you know, to tell you the truth, if I failed out of med school, I actually like research a little bit better and I might be even better off in a PhD program. So who knows? Maybe that's where he'll end up. But oftentimes, if we go all the way through the what if, we realize that we're going to find a solution or a way through and that, you know, that's there on the other side.
Yeah. I want to go back. You had alluded earlier to this idea that, you know, when they, whoever they is, but they say like, oh, the 20s are going to be the best years of your life, right? You sort of hear that out in the ether. So I guess this is sort of a two-part question. One that maybe you kind of already answered, which is this true? but number two, I think we already know you're going to say it's not true. But the other part I'm curious about is, how do you think that mentality, like those expectations, then affect people in their 20s?
Yeah. So it's funny to me because I thought the memo was already out there that your 20s are not going to be the best years of your life. But apparently it isn't, that there's a new crop of 20-somethings every year and they're all somehow part of entering your 20s is receiving this message that these are going to be the best years of your life. Empirically speaking, they are not. And we have to remember that's really amazing news because if your 20s turn out to be the best years of your life, something has gone terribly wrong. So like, that just doesn't even make sense that that's the way adulthood would be set up, that your 20s would be the best years of your life, and then you just suffer through the rest. Unfortunately, that's not the way it is. So there's actually a J-shaped kind of well-being curve or mental health curve that describes how we feel and function throughout life, where it takes a general dip from childhood down through adolescence, often bottoms out in the 20s, and then rises in 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And so again, that's really good news that life should get better as you go. But empirically speaking, okay, sure, in your 20s, maybe you can run your fastest mile. Maybe you look great in a bathing suit or maybe you don't. I don't know. But you're probably not going to be at peak mental health or financial security or home ownership or relationship functioning or knowing who your friends are, where you're going to live or, you know, really anything else. So I think helping people understand that is a relief for them that then they realize, oh, so I'm not blowing it. I'm not doing something wrong. There's not something wrong with me. This feels really hard because it is really hard. And thank goodness these are not going to be the best years of my life.
And it will get better, you know,
Absolutely.
Instilling that hope. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And how, you know, hope may sound like, you know, airy fairy, but all the research shows that hope is one of the best predictors for improving someone's mental health, not just in the long run, but even in the short run, even just in therapy, that a therapist having hope that a client is going to get better, or believing or having the expectation that a client is going to get better, matters a lot for the outcome. I had a client ask me the other day, he was terminating because he was better, as he should be, and was going off on his own. And he said, "What happens when people stop coming to you?" And I said, "You know, what do you mean?" He said, "I'm worried I'm going to get worse." And I said, "I have no reason to believe that, that everything that you've been doing, that you've built and figured out and, you know, gotten together in the time that we've been working together, it's going with you. You're taking all that with you. I have every expectation that you're going to keep doing well and get better as life goes on. And if not, let me know."
Right. I'll be here.
I'll be here.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's helpful for people to understand, really based on the data, I expect my clients' lives to get better. And usually they do.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, "must not take yourself too seriously," and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
So I thought it was really interesting, speaking of your work with your clients, that you say that you won't work with young adults who either don't have a job or aren't willing to get one. So tell us why this is so important.
Yeah, well, because jobs are, you know, the number one factor in positive personality change in your 20s. So all that sort of the increases we're talking about in confidence and managing emotions and coping and structure and meaning and purpose and all that, that improves across people's 20s and 30s. The biggest slice of that improvement, believe it or not, comes from work, even more than from being a partner or a parent. And I'm not saying that's because work is the most important thing in life, but it's probably the thing we spend the most hours a day doing, especially in our 20s. So, you know, 20-somethings who aren't working or aren't willing to work. I have a client right now who is trying to work. She's trying very hard to find a job. And while she doesn't have one, she's very stressed and anxious and crying a lot. And it's very hard to sort of make progress with her, or for her to make progress, when we don't really have anything to work with. She's sort of stuck in her apartment sending out resumes. So I'm happy to work with her because she's trying to find a job, and us coping with what's going on with that process is going to serve her at work. But it, you know, a 20-something who's sort of hanging out, unhappy, not interested in working, not willing to get a job, I don't feel that I can really support that, because one of the things that would make them feel better is to get out of the house and get a job. I don't care how big or how small the job is, just anything to get going and to kind of interact with the world.
And it makes so much sense, because of course, not only are they interacting with the world and there's other people, but it's a place where you learn, where you build skills, where you then gain a sense of mastery and self-efficacy. And so it really makes sense that, especially at that time of life, you know, what the benefits would be. And then, of course, if you're doing work that matters to you, then there's also that, that you're, you know, you're contributing something.
Yeah,
there's
that
sense
really
of meaning
about
and purpose.
Sure.
And so what do you say to people if they say, "Well, I can't work because that's where all of my stress and anxiety comes from. It's work that's causing me to have all of these problems"?
Well, I mean, most 20-somethings I know can't afford not to work. So they they do have to work, but they often will say, you know, work is what's stressing me out. So work is actually the leading cause of stress and anxiety in 20-somethings. Because again, that's what they're doing 40 hours a week. So there are lots of growth opportunities, lots of opportunities to learn and be challenged and to gain new skills, which is what I want. On my side of the room, on their side of the room, that feels really hard and stressful. And they imagine that, well, if I just didn't have to do this, I wouldn't feel so anxious. I wouldn't feel so stressed. You may not, but you also wouldn't be growing and changing as right. much as if you were really challenging yourself.
Well, you'll just work. Have a different brand of anxiety, stress, depression, because you'll be sitting home not doing anything.
Not doing
and not
anything.
Having a sense of purpose and feeling bad about yourself versus
everybody else is busy and they all have jobs and yes.
And can support themselves.
Right.
All of that. What do you think? You know, we know there's been this huge shift since the pandemic to remote work. What's your take on work from home for young adults? Is that, do we think this is good or bad for the 20-somethings? Because we know they want to do it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. They do and they don't. They do. However, to 20-somethings credit out there, I think the more this has been happening, they've been the first ones to say, wow, I'm going crazy and I'm not learning anything and I'm not making connections. This isn't feeling so great. So, you know, I'm not the hugest fan of full-time remote work for 20-somethings. I think hybrid work can be very forgiving. I've been a hybrid worker my whole life before there was such a thing as hybrid work. You may be also as a therapist. Yeah. That was one of the things that really drew me to the profession was the flexibility of it and being able to, you know, sort of make your own hours, work some days, be at the computer other days. So anyway, I'm a big fan of hybrid work. I do think companies, who offer some amount of hybrid options to young adults are going to be more competitive attracting them. Because think about it, they've been in college where everything is on their terms, whether or not they go to class, how they schedule their day, what they take. I mean, it's absolutely all on their terms. So then to go 40 hours a week in front of a desk full time, you know, feels like a big shift that many 20-somethings say, well, I'm out then. I don't want that. Mm-hmm. So I do think hybrid work offers 20-somethings and adults of all ages the ability to say, I want to engage with this amazing career and I don't have to give everything up. I can still figure out other pieces of my life that matter. So I'm a huge fan of hybrid work. I think full-time remote work is generally not the best thing for 20-somethings. I'd have to really... somebody would have to make a really good case for me as to why this was the best thing for them, because we know, I mean, the data's just started coming in, but what the data we have, you know, matches common sense that they're learning less when they work remotely. Their connections aren't as good. They're not feeling as challenged. They're getting less feedback. So, you know, I tell 20-somethings, your job is to get out there and learn as much as you can and get paid for it in your 20s, and that your learning curve in your 20s is going to predict your earning curve in your 30s and beyond. And you're going to learn more if you're in the office with people at least some of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And how much of that social uncertainty, you know, that you called the social anxiety, social uncertainty is getting worse because of how, you know, because we're not interacting with other human beings face to face in the ways that we used to, whether it's because of texting or social media or email or working remotely.
Right, right.
You know, we sort of don't have the opportunities to interact in person the way that we did in the past. And I have to imagine that a lot of that is contributing to these rising rates of what they're calling social anxiety, what you're calling, you know, social uncertainty too.
Yeah. And so I think obviously getting in there with people and having the opportunities to be in those meetings and figure out how to speak up and raise your hand or how to give the presentation or how to ask a mentor, hey, can I have coffee with you today? I'd really love to ask about your path. That all those opportunities are just, they're just harder to initiate on the screen. And also there's the piece of getting dressed and getting up and getting out of the house and getting out in the world. It really makes a difference for people. It's, you know, all those college students who were doing college on Zoom, they hated it. And as they should have, that it's a drag and it's not great for your mental health to sit in your jammies all day and look at a screen. And so the same goes for work.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I work from home and I sometimes will even wear my high heels because I'm like, I just need to feel like a real human being. Yeah. And my son will say, why are you so fancy? Told me, when my shoes go clip-clop, that means I'm fancy.
Yes. My daughter used to, when she was little, when the defining decade came out, she was in like preschool, and she used to put on my high heels and walk around the house and say, let's talk about 20-somethings.
Besides,
she perceived whenever those heels were put on and I left the house, that's what I was going
to
do.
That's what you were doing.
That's still what I'm doing. And she's in high school.
Oh, that's so funny. I love it. So I know we're coming to the end of our time here. So I really just have one more question. The book is so great. There are so many more topics that, of course, we didn't have time to get to. You write chapters on how to love, how to have sex. Every chapter is kind of it's a how-to, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a guidebook. How to move, how to cook. I loved that how to cook was in there. How to change, how to make decisions. I mean, just so that, and what the chapters were like relatively short. They were kind of bite-sized for a book. And so I felt like I got, they were like chock full of information, but in a really readable format.
Thank you.
And we all know that our attention spans seem to be declining over time. So I think this is really great. And honestly, I think this book would be helpful for anyone really in their late teens through their early 30s. You know, there's so much in it that I think developmentally kind of spans that whole like young adulthood time.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, I say I specialize in 20-somethings, and I do, you know, plus or minus 5 years.
Plus or minus, yeah.
a teenager who's, you know, really curious and wants to grow and learn. I mean, they're already reading The Defining Decade. They're going to go by the 20-something treatment, try to get ahead. I love it. And then 30-somethings out there, you know, I always say, life isn't over at 30. You're not done. You don't have to have everything done by 30, but let's try to start a lot before 30.
Definitely. You know. Yeah. Yeah. And I think if there are 30-year-olds that are a little slow to get going with their adulting, you know, this, I think this book could be super helpful for them too. So the last question I wanted to ask about is kind of going back to this idea of purpose. We talked about how work can give a sense of purpose, but do you think that sometimes this word becomes sort of misunderstood, like in 20-somethings? And talk about that a little bit. Like, how do you address purpose with 20-somethings?
I mean, I think that a lot of young adults, and I was the same when I was in my 20s, you know, they say, I want my life to have purpose. I want my life to have meaning, or my work to have purpose and meaning. And I want that too. I want that for me. I want that for you. Yeah. But I think to really understand, to all the psychologists out there, y'all know Maslow's hierarchy, you know, self-actualization or purpose or meaning. I mean, this is the cherry on top, you know, so this may not be the thing that you figured out at 21. And that's okay. You don't need to feel behind or stressed or anxious about it. It's great you're looking for it and that you want it. It's okay if you haven't figured it out yet. So I think a lot of 20-somethings in that kind of catastrophic way say, oh, I haven't found purpose and meaning. My entire life is going to be devoid of purpose and meaning. So I try to normalize the fact that only about 50% of 30-somethings say, or 30-year-olds say that they've found a sense of purpose and meaning. And then another 25% usually say they've found or chosen a sense of purpose and meaning by 35. And then after that, you know, the other 25% are still working on it. So just to normalize, it's okay if you don't have that yet. You don't need to panic about this, but it's great you're thinking about it. Another thing about purpose is that I think that people imagine that they're going to like find it, that, you know, it's out there to be found rather than it's something that we can choose to put in our lives. So we choose to either have work or hobbies or relationships or conversations that feel important and meaningful, or we don't. But it's not this thing that's hiding under a rock out there for you to go and like turn over the right rock and find it. Anyone can have some purpose or meaning in their lives any day they choose to have it. You just need to choose to have it. And so that may mean, oh, I start volunteering, or I, you know, dig into my family a little bit more, or I pay more attention to how my work could be meaningful. But it's probably not this thing you're going to find outside of yourself.
Yeah. And I think of it almost more like a process rather than an outcome, you know, or I've seen people get sort of stuck around this age group. You know, there's almost this expectation that it's just going to fall in their lap and they just kind of like wait for it, or, you know, like I can't go get a job because working at, I don't know, Starbucks, that's not my purpose
and
my meaning.
Right.
but it doesn't have to be, right? When you're a young person, like, you work and you figure out what pieces of that are a good fit for you and not a good fit, and that informs the next decision and the next decision, and that it's really more of this like process discovery kind of growth that happens over time versus like this thing that makes you go, well, forget it. I just can't work until I figure out what my purpose is.
Right.
Right. Or I can't live until I figure out what my purpose is.
And if my 23-year-old job does not yet have purpose, then I can't do it.
Exactly.
I worked a lot. Well, all of my jobs had purpose when you think of it, because they were either paying the bills or allowing me to study for the GRE.
Right.
They all had a purpose. Yeah. You know, some of them felt more meaningful than others, but for them to understand, it doesn't mean you're not going to get there. And that's great that you're not satisfied with a job that doesn't feel meaningful. So how can we help you build the skills that you need so that you can actually get one of those jobs?
Yeah. Well said. Well, is there anything else that we haven't talked about? I mean, I know there's lots of things that we haven't talked about, but is there anything else that you feel like you'd really like for our listeners to know?
I mean, I think what I want listeners to understand, or what I want, the reason I wrote the book is that it's really, I think, important that we put 20-somethings in context and look at mental health in the context of, you know, what it's like to be a 20-something today. And once we do that, I think it's harder to call them snowflakes or to say they all have helicopter parents, which they don't. I've had a lot of 20-somethings who would have given anything for a helicopter parent. You know, I think we might think twice about diagnosing entire generations with problems that maybe they don't have. But, you know, it's a very tough time. It's an uncertain age more than it's, you know, sort of an unwell generation or an unwell group of people.
Context matters.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Well, this has been so great. Thank you so much for joining me. I think our listeners are going to get a whole lot out of this, and I've really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you. Thank you, Jill. You were a great interviewer.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can get more psychology tips by subscribing to our newsletter and connecting with us on social media.
We'd like to thank our podcast production manager, Jadine Stout-Williams.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources page of our website, offtheclockpsych.com.